portez le masque et de laver vos mains. La dose de rappel, un moyen de nous protéger plus longtemps. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
So, hey, I'm Alexis. I'm part of Punch Up Collective here in unceded Algonquin land, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada.
And I'm Chris. I'm also a member of Punch Up Collective.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to be talking about what's going on in Ottawa, and we're just going to dive into it. So let's go back to the beginning. What's the initial thing you want to just kind of say to everybody listening about what's happening on the ground right now?
So there's so many first things I want to say to everyone. I guess, you know, like I could start by saying before this convoy rolled into our city, we had a bunch of conversations about what's coming up, like what kind of resistance is happening. You know, we were sort of like, is anyone working on this? We looked around, we asked people, and the general vibe was, you know, this is just going to be another thing like the last time a right-wing convoy came to Ottawa in 2019, Yellow Vest convoy, which we can talk more about their politics and continuities with this. But we were just like, yeah, you know, Ottawa is a capital city. There is like a protest every day here on Parliament Hill. We usually don't go to them. We only usually really like set up organizing to oppose them if they are overtly, you know, horrible. We've done that a lot too, but we were just like, they're going to drive up here on a Friday and downtown Ottawa is dead. No one is there because it's government workers. They're not there. And they're going to hang out maybe for the weekend and leave. Like, so we just really did not understand what was going to happen at all. That's what I would say first. What would you say?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we had this precedent from 2019 where there was a smaller truck convoy that came from out west, primarily from Alberta. And particularly for folks who don't live in the Canadian context, it's important to understand that Alberta is sort of like the Texas of Canada politically, right? It's like, it's really like a province that's based on a resource extraction economy, has a really high concentration of right-wing formations, organizations, and parasitic political parties. And so back in 2019, there was a convoy that was opportunistically taking up what was happening in France around the Yellow Vest movement to forward a right-wing politics that was overtly anti-immigrant and was also opposed to carbon taxes, which the federal government in Canada was trying to push through at that time. So they came out here and drove some trucks around Ottawa. It was mildly annoying, but it wasn't at this scale, and it was really temporary. Some people organized some counter-protests, but they just weren't here for that long. And we mistakenly thought that it would be like that this time, and we were wrong.
Just to be clear, the Yellow Vests, a lot of people listening to this may be aware of that movement that like exploded in France. In France, it had a much more anti-capitalist bent to it, and also anti-fascist really physically drove out a lot of the far-right elements that tried to get involved. But in Canada, it took on a very much far-right kind of populist, like Trumpian angle to it. I just want to be clear about that.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for making that clear. That's right. In the French context, my understanding was that politically it was much more heterogeneous, right? That there was a lot of like tensions and conflicts that played out within the Yellow Vest movement. Whereas here, it was really that there were some right-wing formations that were seeing an opportunity mm-hmm. to mobilize a set of symbols that they thought could kind of speak to their sense of a kind of like white Canadian nationalist imagination, right? And they took that and put it onto the truck convoy with their very particular right-wing politics.
Well, do you want to talk about, I know like a lot of groups like Anti-Hate Canada, I think is one of the main sites that's written a lot about this. But do you want to talk at all about like who some of these groups are that like organize this convoy? I know some of the main organizers like are espousing like anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, or they're like promoting QAnon. But I mean, they're obviously on the very far right side of the spectrum. I don't know if you want to talk about kind of like where these demos kind of come out of.
So I'm not going to get into the really specific personalities. I think it's worth actually, that's right. The Canadian Anti-Hate Network has actually done some very deep research into some of the specific people who've done like fundraising and circulated the calls on social media and really seem to be playing like key leadership roles in organizing to get the convoy here, and then actually in the context of the ongoing convoy occupation in Ottawa, seem to be playing pretty central leadership roles. But I think the important thing to understand is that this is a really politically eclectic situation. Mm-hmm. And you experience that even more, like we've gone out and spent time actually exploring this occupation and trying to get a better sense of it. And we can talk more about what that looks like. But the thing to understand is that there are some key people who have long track records, well-documented track records with far-right formations, exactly as you say, connected to various kinds of conspiracy theorists, connected to also some of the kind of weird secessionist movement in Alberta, which is one manifestation of the far right out west, as well as to very clear and overt white supremacist politics. And we've seen visibly here the Confederate flag at various points, as well as a Nazi flag. Now, that's not to say that everyone who's participating in the convoy occupation in downtown Ottawa are adherents to those politics. But it's clear that there are some people who've really placed themselves in central leadership roles who are trying to move those politics and tap into what we see as a kind of white supremacist Canadian common sense. Does that make sense?
I think that's in many ways kind of scarier. It's like if the leadership is like very far right and trying to move the sort of like populist movement that's like, you know, framed around like, you know, freedom and, you know, letting people decide their own lives and stuff. I mean, if they're trying to move that in a certain direction, that's scarier than just a couple random folks showing up, like flying swastika flags, I feel like.
One thing that I really think it's important to know about the difference between race in the U.S. and race in the Canadian context is exactly around this thing that I think they're really leveraging. So in the Canadian context, there was a long period of overt white supremacist immigration policies that were meant to build a white nation. And those shifted formally in the 60s toward an official state-sponsored policy of multiculturalism, right? So multiculturalism from above. So Canada has this kind of, in addition to like constantly priding itself on not being the U.S., one of the ways that Canada talks about that is the U.S. is a melting pot and everyone's supposed to become American, but Canada is a mosaic and everyone gets to just be their special selves. But what that does is mean that when, in the Canadian context, when white supremacists and white nationalists are talking, they lean heavily on this idea that also shows up in the U.S., but they lean heavily on this idea that the way for things to go along and be in harmony is for everyone to have their own separate cultural enclaves that are accommodated and respected, but always within this purview of whiteness being the including, accommodating force, that otherness, like cultural otherness, is always rendered as the site of racism and the problem. So that's like very strong in Canada, is this kind of commitment to a particular kind of diversity, formal diversity, that actually ends up reconstituting white supremacy. And I can say something, well, maybe jumping ahead too much, about the different ways that this is actually like showing up here, I think. So like, I cannot overstate how much different it is to be a white person going down into the area that these folks are occupying and being racialized, like being what in Canada is called a visible minority. Because as when I go down there as a white person, I am so welcomed. So welcomed, even when I'm wearing a mask, which is clearly a political thing for me to be doing in that context. They are like, hello, you clearly disagree with us because you're wearing a mask. Let's talk about how you actually might find some real bases of unity with us here. So that was like overwhelmingly my experience, and the experience of the other people I was walking around doing stuff with there. There's just so many stories. Like one young Black woman I know they've been walking with, you know, in groups because it's scary. And they live there. They live in these neighborhoods. And they have had a number of times where someone in the convoy will ask to take a selfie with them. And then when they say no, like throw racial epithets at them. There's a bunch of like younger racialized people who are working in hotels, who are just living down there, who've had cigarettes thrown at them, who've been shoved and punched. It's a totally different experience. And that is something that really, it really tells you something about the way that the Canadian flag, which is the main flag that's being flown there, is signaling just totally different things if you're a white person looking at this than if you're and experiencing it than if you're racialized. So it's a different experience of the occupation, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about who these people are, because I think one of the other things is that, just like in the U.S. where we had this period up until Charlottesville where the right was really pushing this like free speech rally thing to kind of like sidestep the far right politics of the event, it seems like in Ottawa they've really tried to brand it around freedom and, you know, we're just working class truckers trying to like make our lives better. So who are the folks that are out there? One of the things that we're hearing in the United States is that a lot of people are from the U.S. A lot of people are far-right activists. They're not necessarily truck drivers. Obviously, there are some truckers there because there's a bunch of trucks. And also, there's people like Joe Rogan that are saying there's like 50,000 trucks out there, which seems to not be true. So talk about the size and like who are the folks that are there? And like you said, you've kind of like walked around the occupation. Like, talk a little bit about that. Like, what does this thing look like and who are the people that are out there?
It's kind of astonishing, actually, for any of us who have spent time in large scale convergences as part of protest movements in the past. There's much of it that would feel eerily familiar and kind of bizarre at the same time. So basically, it's a completely decentralized occupation. There is not really one area where everyone is gathered. But what they did is they drove a whole bunch of trucks. And it's important to say here, there are some truckers who drove long haul trucks into this, but actually it's a lot of pickup trucks and other kinds of vehicles as well. And we're talking about probably somewhere in the realm of 400 to 500 vehicles. And they cover quite a large area of downtown Ottawa. I mean, like blocks and blocks and blocks, kind of congregated around Parliament, which is sort of at the top of downtown. And that's where they've really got most of the vehicles kind of like lined up along this one street called Wellington, which is right in front of Parliament. And then throughout this, so it's basically all of these various vehicles are clogging the streets and making some streets completely impassable. There are various tents that people have set up. There's actually quite a lot of infrastructure that people have built. There's multiple sites where people basically have outdoor kitchens going. There's at least one children's play area. There's a bunch of kids. People brought a lot of children with them. So it's actually a very kind of multi-generational lively. I mean, people are hanging out, talking, playing music. And when you look at them, they're overwhelmingly white and they're overwhelmingly men. And what we know is that the there's like a very tiny group of like compared to like the amount of truckers that do cross-border trucking in the Canadian US context. This is a very kind of small sliver of that group. And then a whole bunch of other people who have been inspired in some way or another to join in to the occupation. And you're right that freedom is the symbol that they're really proclaiming and mobilizing. And part of their whole kind of recruitment spiel is, you believe in freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of slogan that you see everywhere. But within that umbrella, as you walk around, you see people have like handwritten, hand-painted signs and graffiti all over the place. It's really quite, it goes in so many different directions, right? Where you can basically see every single kind of conspiracy theory that you've ever heard of. Someone is espousing it in the midst of this occupation. And then there are the more kind of consistent anti-mandate slogans, and then some really very particular stuff that's about hating on the Trudeau government, the Liberal government that is in charge of the federal level of government in Canada right now. So it's kind of all of that in this weird, messy package that is at this point really dug in, like really quite settled in the midst of like the winter in downtown Ottawa. And it's hard to say. I mean, this is a very particular mobilization of whiteness in Canada, and is also, I think, really creating an opportunity for far-right activists to engage with a much broader layer of people who are having a kind of radicalization experience, right? Like they're feeling the power that some of us have felt too of holding the streets together and building community and identity in that way. Except the thing is they're building a really terribly reactionary common identity together. Yeah. And it's unclear where that's gonna go. There's a lot of different forces on the right and the far right who are all jockeying right now to figure out how they can use this, right? Like where they can take this politically in the Canadian context.
But in terms of how it's actually manifesting, like it's a bit like a combination of a long-term camping trip, like the way that people like set up whole campsites and like visit each other's campsites, a like church picnic and a traffic jam. That's the vibe. And I think I want to really emphasize something that you said, which is there are substantial representation of people from the Ottawa area who are coming in, you know, on the weekend, driving across from Quebec, which is just across the river. And really a lot of like actual church, I think that church picnic vibe and the sort of like many kitchens, like there are actual churches who have been at some of the forefront of anti-vaccine direct action in Canada, like refusing to limit attendance, refusing to require masks. That's been a major political tendency among conservative Christian churches here. And I think they are really out in force. Like I had a couple of conversations where they shifted really smoothly from enjoining me to believe in freedom to enjoining me to believe in the saving power of Jesus Christ, right? Like it was all one sentence for them. So that's also part of the different ways that it is feeling welcoming to people.
And the other thing to understand about what it looks like is that numerically during the week, yeah, we're actually only talking about a few hundred people who are holding down this occupation in downtown Ottawa. On the weekends now, we've had two weekends, and we'll see what happens in this coming weekend. There's much, much more of a surge of people coming in from other areas who they're not coming in to spend the night. They're coming in to go and participate in protests and actually what seem like kind of like almost like celebratory activities.
Yeah, they're like, they're drunk in the day. They're there to party. And though it's also interesting, like, because I'm the kind of person when I'm at a protest or an action or I'm at a, you know, hub center for, I'm one of the people who like gets kind of anxious if I'm not working on something. So I'll be like going around, like picking up plates and like, you know, making sure there's toilet paper. And there's also like just a enormous quantity of people who I'm like, you're the me of this. Like, they're going around emptying the trash, bringing jerry cans of fuel to make sure that everyone's gassed up so they can continue idling for a 14th day. You know, it's like massive amounts of helping each other out.
The trucks are just like in the street?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like two, usually, streets in downtown Ottawa are not very wide. So there's usually two lanes of parked vehicles with, again, as Chris mentioned, like, the cops say that there's about 100 kids living in these vehicles down there. So there's like families. And then there's usually one lane that's left clear for ambulances and regular traffic, including the people who are coming from the suburbs to drive in to join for the day or whatever. They've clearly responded to early on. There was a widely circulated report that a ambulance had been unable to get through and that the person in that ambulance died. And I haven't seen very much about that, but they've responded to this concern. Oh, you need us to be able to let emergency vehicles through. So it's technically possible to get through these streets.
Not all of them, but
yeah, not all of them. Most of them.
You know, how has the state responded? And if this is really just a question of several hundred like vehicles, like, why hasn't the state just like gotten a tow truck and like towed them away? Or
so there's a couple different ways to answer that question. Obviously, that's the question that many people have been asking themselves in Ottawa, particularly liberals who live in and adjacent to the downtown area.
And I'm sure you're aware of this, and a lot of people listening to this are aware of, especially if you're reading the It's Going Down column about what goes on in Canada every week. But I mean, for us in the U.S., we've just been watching hundreds of people getting kicked out of them and being arrested every week for trying to stop the logging of old growth in British Columbia. Yeah. On top of the Wet'suwet'en territories getting flooded with RCMP and people getting arrested and stuff being burnt down. And obviously, you know, they have resources for that, which is a massive, massive mobilization. But yet somebody parks their car out in front of the front lawn and it's like, oh, you know, like government over.
No, I mean, there's massive Indigenous protests, you know, all through Idle No More. And every single one of those that I have ever gone to, there have been many snipers on the roofs of downtown. Just like recently, the Movement for Black Lives has been doing some intersection occupation and, you know, just get arrested brutally, you know.
Within a couple of days.
Well, within a day.
Like, yeah, and sometimes yeah. Within a day. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So many people have pointed out this, like,
huge discrepancy.
Yeah, this vast double standard, right, and how the policing is happening here.
They have saunas, right? Like, they have saunas. They're taking saunas.
The people who are occupying have brought in three saunas.
Yeah.
But the thing to say about the state response is, first of all, yes, to really foreground that there is this this incredible double standard, right, in terms of where the policing resources go. And yes, obviously, the Canadian state has been going hard on Indigenous land defenders, on people defending old growth out west, on blockades like in Wet'suwet'en territories, and all the solidarity actions that have happened alongside those, including rail blockades in many places. In all of those situations, right, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in particular have been very well mobilized and very well resourced to target people. And so in this context, they've made different choices. And they claim, at least locally, the Ottawa Police Service claims that they were really caught off guard. And also they were really intimidated by the threat of violence from this crowd associated with the convoy. We're not totally sure how to assess those claims. Now, it is true that materially, the convoy has brought in, you know, a few hundred trucks, and there are some vehicles that are close to Parliament where they've actually taken the tires off and made it much more difficult for them to be moved. And in the meantime, reportedly, the various towing companies in the area have been refusing to work with the police in moving these trucks for fear of being targeted by people associated with the occupation. So basically, they don't, and especially for towing companies that work a lot with trucking, they do not want to get smeared for towing some of these vehicles out. But that's just the kind of like material situation.
I mean, the other part of the material situation is like last weekend, I think there were like 1500 people and the OPS can field 150 officers like at max strength in a day. So they do have this kind of narrative that they just don't have, they just don't have the people power. And if they had more resources, then maybe they would have been able to do something. But the ideological thing and the actual practices are something else. So like Ottawa is a heavily policed city. It's a heavily policed city, and the Ottawa police are very used to having thousands and thousands of people down in that same area for Canada Day. And they are able to search every single person's backpack to see if they're carrying liquor. This is not something that they're not used to. So in actual practice, for example, finally, they went to one of the places where many of the trucks and sort of fellow travelers were camped out, where the saunas are, this road near Coventry Road, it's called, and went in to take out confiscate some of the jerry cans of fuel and some of the propane tanks that were being used for the collective kitchens. And there was this kind of line, like, we're really cracking down now, so we're not going to let more fuel in. Like, they'll just have to figure this out, right? But many people have said, like, there's just streams of people walking back and forth with jerry cans full of fuel. And people will say, like, I talked to a cop as I was standing and watching, you know, 10 people walk by carrying fuel canisters. And the cop said, my job is just to report that it's happening. I'm not supposed to intervene in this. So the other thing that does seem like, I don't know, it is a very Canadian thing and it's a very Ottawa thing. And maybe this is similar to the ways that it works in other capital cities. There's this constant question about whose job it is to protect the Canadian state. And the Ottawa police have really also been framing this. And indeed, some of the liberals in government have been framing the OPS's job as protecting the people of Ottawa and the city of Ottawa. And this is directed at the state. And so they think that it should be the RCMP or the military who's responsible for this. So some of that is also about just like how people think about budget lines and who's going to take the fall. And the police chief, definitely every time he's talked about it, he's really been wanting to pass the buck up so that it's someone else's job to, you know, defend Parliament, basically. I would say also, well, maybe do you have anything else to say about the cops and their response?
The only other thing that I think is really important to emphasize about the cops is that part of what we've done in Punch Up Collective over the last few years, in conjunction with defund police efforts here and elsewhere, is trace out the history of racism and violence by the Ottawa police. And, you know, they, like so many police forces across this continent, have a long history of targeting and brutalizing Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And that is clearly structured in to policing in Ottawa, right? Like that racist approach, it's not an accident. It's not a few bad apples, as some people would claim. And at the individual officer level, there's quite a lot of racism as well, right? Just like on a cop by cop level. And so our hunch too is that that kind of structural racism that's part of how auto policing happens and the interpersonal racism of individual cops is playing into how they're relating with this convoy occupation and the kind of way that they are in many ways facilitating it and have facilitated it occupying the city in a way that would have never happened if this was Indigenous land defense initiative or part of the movement for Black lives.
And people in participants in the convoy occupation, at, you know, various times, if you spend a bad night watching their videos, one of the things that they really believe is that the cops are on their side, that they are sympathetic, that they support the movement, but they're just, you know, really have to like protect their jobs, which are already embattled. And so, in a certain way, that is really what they perceive to be happening. And that is what everyone perceives to be happening. So, it matters if there's overt support from, but you know, it just, the police services in the Canadian context also like in many places in the US have been very resistant to, vaccination, and there's been some of those tendencies also within police. So it's plausible that in places where an officer might do something, they wouldn't.
What about the role of the Conservative Party in all this? Because they've seemed to have taken on sort of like an arbitrary role between the Trudeau government and the convoy. And our understanding is that recently, somebody that was at the head of the party was kicked out because they weren't in support of the convoy protests enough. And now somebody new has come in that's even more pro convoy protests. So talk about that. How is sort of like, quote, mainstream conservatives lined up alongside the convoy protests?
Yeah, so it's true. I mean, so the far right in the Canadian context has been emboldened ever since the Trump election. And we've had to deal with that in Ottawa for a number of years now, with various kinds of far-right white nationalist and white supremacist formations attempting to hold rallies on Parliament Hill, occupy space in the city, hold events. And because it's the capital city in the Canadian context, they kind of see this as a place where they should try to take up space and gain visibility. And so we've had to try to figure out how to undermine those efforts. And as part of that kind of emboldened far right, there has also been a real struggle that's been brewing within the Conservative Party. And for folks in the US, the Conservative Party in Canada is the right wing party that is not exactly the same as the Republican Party. It's a different kind of formation. It's important not to see them exactly the same. That said, there is a kind of growing faction in the Conservative Party that seems to be quite inspired by what they've observed in the US with the Republican Party, particularly with the kind of organizing around a pro-Trump politics. And they, I think, want to try to run with that, to use that as an opportunity to take over leadership of the Conservative Party. So there'd been this person who was the elected leader of the Conservative Party, Erin O'Toole, who lost the last federal election. That was when Justin Trudeau, the Liberal, was elected. And since then, there's been a lot of fighting internally within the Conservative Party about how did Erin O'Toole fail, right? And people on the right of the Conservative Party basically feel that he failed by not adhering enough to social conservatism, by not going hard on stuff around anti-queer laws and policies. that on not bringing up the question of abortion, which in many ways has been a settled question federally in Canada for a long time now, and other things too. And so in the first week of this downtown occupation with the truck convoy, there was a full upheaval that happened in the Conservative Party. I don't think these things are disconnected. I think that these folks on the right in the Conservative Party felt inspired by what they were seeing just outside in the streets, and they called for a no confidence vote for Erin O'Toole, and he lost. He got kicked out as the leader. And so there's an interim leader of the Conservative Party right now, and they're going to have to elect a new leader. And there's going to be a lot of jockeying around who is going to be that new leader. And is that person going to be pushing more of this kind of further to the right politics? And there certainly are a number of characters in the Conservative Party who are well placed to do that and are keen to do that, and really see the truck convoy that's happening here, but also the kinds of truck blockades that are happening in other parts of the Canadian context right now as fertile ground for building a constituency that they think can kind of help lead them into running the Conservative Party. So basically what we might be seeing is some realignment in right-wing politics in the Canadian context. So far, the far right has been fairly disconnected from the Conservative Party. In fact, many of them have congregated around other party-building efforts further to the right. But increasingly, some of them are trying to use the Conservative Party as a vehicle. And there are people in the Conservative Party who opportunistically see this as a way to build, right, to try to actually gain more power. So it's a shift.
Yeah. But it's not clear what's going to happen exactly, right? So the person who's the interim leader, Candace Bergen, who's not the actor that played Murphy Brown in television in the 80s and 90s, has been seen pictured having pizza with convoy leaders and sort of generally chumming around. But part of the structure is the interim leader cannot be selected as the
next leader,
the next real leader. So her overt friendliness with this is, you know, maybe kind of a test balloon, and I think some of that decision about what's going to happen with the Conservatives might come down to what happens with this as a kind of movement and formation across the Canadian context.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, hides the face, lies the snake, the sun in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, neath the black, the sky looks dead. Sun, won't you come and wash away the rain? Black hole sun, won't you come, won't you come, won't you come? Stuttering, cold and damp, steal the warm wind, tired friend. Gone for honest men, and sometimes far too long for snakes. In my shoes, walk and sleep. In my youth, I pray to keep heaven send hell away. No one sings like you. Black hole sun. hang my head, drown my fear, till they all just disappear. Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away?
Let's switch gears here. Let's talk about how have the people of Ottawa responded. What does that look like to you all?
Well, you know, one of the really wonderful things is this is, you know, I would rather this wasn't happening. And I have never seen so many ordinary Ottawa people who are not, don't consider themselves political, so incensed about racism. Just like so activated to want to do something. And so just pissed. It's very striking. And also just like really, really a lot of people who have never gone to a protest before, who have never sort of reached out to try to connect, participating in, doing things like forming Discord servers to, hook up to walk people home or to work to help people get groceries, like people, you know, signing up to like drive in from out of town to come pick up your meds for you. So just like really quite a degree of trying to take care of strangers that was nascent and that did some work during the early stages of the pandemic here, but did not in any way have this kind of passion or staying power. But that I think maybe came out of some of those formulations of mutual aid in the early days of the pandemic and in Ottawa. So that's been really notable. People are, have been really like trying to figure out, like, how do we think about all of this, you know, cognitive dissonance that we're having here. So there's a lot of people who don't identify as activists who are like really naming, like, wait, the police behave like this when it's racialized people and like this when it's these white people, majority white people. What's going on there? Wait, the police say they are incapable of doing anything. They literally do not have the power. That's what the cops are saying. Like, we cannot do anything about this. We don't have. So they're like, what are you for? I don't know if you're for anything then. Like, what's the good of you, right? I thought you were to help when things are happening. So that's, there's just this kind of like interesting, and there's just a proliferation of those kinds of like very, I don't know. They're not centrally organized. They're organic and a lot of really newbies getting together, trying to do things. And then there's also these kinds of formulations that are happening more at the sort of professional class and like city councilor level, which are more complicated. So some of those have been, there's some sort of progressive city councilors who've been trying to voice that this is something that the mayor should really relate to. Many of those calls have been just calls for more policing. But also the thing that's complicated for us as anarchists is to think about one of the most effective things has been a civil case brought by a lawyer, Paul Champ, to basically charge people for the disruption and in people's lives of, at the beginning, there was constant honking, including like a train whistle, that just at decibel levels that were incredible and extremely traumatic for like pets and people, and just no one could sleep for all this time. And a young woman, Zexi Lee, said that she would stand as the plaintiff in a civil class action suit, and a judge brought down an injunction to say that the honking of horns wasn't an expression of political, you know, freedom, right? It wasn't saying anything in effect. So that's like been such a relief for people who just wanted to get some sleep and not feel constantly assaulted by the sound. But it's also something we're going to have to organize against later, right? Like it also sets up some potentially worrying things. So that's always the situation, right? Any win we make is just the site of the next struggle. And then there's these other sort of layers of the more like what you would expect of like people who are already activists and union leadership. There's a ton of national unions headquartered here. And that is actually kind of, those things are all really complicated, more complicated to talk about.
Yeah, so the social democratic left in Ottawa has really been stumbling and trying to determine what kind of response to do to the convoy besides just denouncing it. And then the sort of broader activist left has been deeply engaged in a lot of debate around how to challenge the convoy occupation. And certainly there are the kind of low level everyday forms of resistance that people are engaged in. Like probably some of your listeners have seen the images of like graffiti on some of the convoy cars telling them to go home. There are people who have individually stood in front of trucks or yelled at them or set up loudspeakers with music to interfere with what they're doing. So there's every day there are people who are confronting them in overt and less overt ways all the time. And at the same time, a lot of people who live in and adjacent to downtown have been really afraid. You know, as Alexis highlighted, particularly Black, Indigenous, and people of color who live in that area have been really targeted in consistent ways. But also white people in masks have been regularly getting assaulted. We've heard multiple stories of even kids and teenagers getting attacked or intimidated in various ways. A lot of the debate here among the kind of broader activist scene has been about, well, what do we do? And there's been a lot of careful thinking about how do we oppose this truck convoy occupation without escalating the kind of violence that people are going to experience who live in and adjacent to downtown. So many people have been putting a lot of their energy into these mutual aid efforts around the like escorting people, getting people the supplies they need, even just supplying people with earplugs and noise canceling headphones during the height of the honking. And increasingly there are discussions about organizing a counter protest. There was one counter protest that was organized through Reddit last weekend where about 300 people showed up. And I think mostly were people who hadn't previously been involved in protests or activism, but were just really, really angry. And that's, you know, that's a complicated and contradictory set of people, because some of those folks really, what they're calling for is for the cops and the military to come in. And as anarchists, we're not at all interested in that solution. This coming weekend, Saturday, there's going to be the first mass counter protest against the truck convoy occupation, and that's been called in part by some people associated with local unions. And it will be really interesting to see what it looks like when lots of people are out in the streets directly denouncing the convoy. Now, part of what's challenging in counter-protesting the convoy, as we discussed earlier, is that it is so decentralized. There's not one point of conflict or contact, right? They're dispersed throughout all of downtown. So we don't even know in a kind of tactical sense what it would look like to have a counter protest that could have any kind of effectiveness with such a dispersed set of people and all of their vehicles. And for the moment, at least, the kinds of ways that people are thinking about counter protesting aren't about actually trying to directly go and antagonize them. It's more about trying to build some collective power in our city and try to have a sense of seizing back space.
But, you know, part of this also is about the layers of history in Ottawa. So there have been really overt anti-fascist direct confrontation politics here, waves of it, you know, from way before I've lived here. So like in the early 90s, like just, but the most recent iteration of a sort of formal collective working against fascism in Ottawa broke, you know, dissolved 3-4 years ago. So there's also a lot of things that we could say about, like, as we're thinking about what we need to build here that this has revealed we didn't have, you know, there's a lot of the ecosystem of what could have had an effective, like, you know, the only way to actually deal with fascist authoritarians is to directly confront them. And we didn't do that. And so we've been really, like, thinking about that and what it means to be now in, like, a war of position, right? And it's a different terrain than if we hadn't let them get entrenched.
Do you want to just talk about, like, the ways that people are organizing?
It's really interesting and disparate. So there's, like I said, there's a bunch of places that people are talking to each other on Discord and Reddit. And those seem to be really different conversations. I sort of dip into both of them. Again, like, many new people who are trying to, like, organize together for the first time, having never put a protest on the internet. So that's also, like, so daunting. And so I feel like it's so amazing that I would literally never do that. That seems so hard to me, but they are persevering and it's really great. And then there's layers of the sort of union folks who are used to working together. And so they've been having more like in-person Zoom meetings. And also I get the sense that there's a lot of union folks who are like having smaller meetings between each other to plan out like what might be possible and how to talk to their membership and leverage people, mobilize people, town halls. So that's partially like municipal level councillors and then provincial level politicians who have some roots in social movements, social democratic social movements in the Ontario context. So that's also like a really interesting mush, you know, and like, and then there's a bunch of kind of like aging anarchists who many people who kind of remember those previous struggles against white supremacists in town and trying to bring some other things. So various signal threads and phone calls. And I mean, it's, you know, it's just organizing in the pandemic sucks. I know that like certain parts of it are better in terms of like many more people being able to just beam in when their kid has gone to sleep. And I really appreciate that. And also it's like, I just don't know how many more like signal threads with a bunch of people who I don't actually know who they are I want to be on to try to plan something. You know what I mean?
Because some people have asked, like, you know, why hasn't there been big protests? We heard that some of the unions had organized stuff, but those were called off by the unions themselves. Yeah, I'm just curious, you know, in terms of like street mobilization, where do you think that is at?
Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, as I said, we have the first kind of call now for a mass counter-protest that's supposed to happen on Saturday. And I think previously people have had a lot of fear and reticence around that, primarily because they don't want to escalate the kind of violence and harassment that people who live in the area are already experiencing on a daily basis. And because there are these like previous histories in Ottawa of times when people have engaged in direct confrontation with forces of the far right. But I think many people don't have that in recent memory. So it's not actually like a practice that a lot of people have access to, particularly folks who are newer to some of the radical politics in the city. And so our hope is that with more kind of a larger scale of street mobilization we might be able to actually exercise more power in seizing back space in the city. But we have real questions about what we can fully achieve at this point when the truck convoy occupation is so dug in and so well supplied and given such a free pass by the police. So it's in many ways an open question.
Because this is circulating a little bit, and I think it's important for us to talk about it. So there was a meeting that only one member from PunchUp was able to go to. Neither of us were there, but Dan reported back to us. And the way that this is being talked about, at that meeting, there was a sort of like, okay, this was about the protest that was called by someone on Reddit for last Saturday. And which I don't know when you're going to air this, but so that would be the third. And the way that it's being represented is that a bunch of people were leveraging identity politics. That's how it's been talked about in the aftermath, that it wasn't safe to directly confront the convoy members and that we should just wait for the military to come in. And so in this narrative that I think is circulating, there's been this line set up where it's basically like, oh, racialized people are scared to confront white supremacists and are actually like betraying the working class. And I really want to like push back on that because I think it is absolutely not, I mean, for one thing, it's absolutely not the case that racialized people in Ottawa don't know how to confront white supremacy. They really do. They do it directly, collectively all the time in organized groups. Like that is happening here. I really think that this is, I mean, and for sure, there might be some ways that the tendency of unions to be careful and want to, in this moment, right, like not directly go to direct confrontation might have been part of this thing that happened. We saw all of these organizations in town be like, we are now officially discouraging you from going to this protest on Saturday. And I think that's why one of the reasons those numbers were so low last weekend. And now those same organizations are officially encouraging people to go to the protest that's happening this coming week. So I regard that whole thing as part of a ongoing complicated conversation about what it means to directly confront white supremacism, especially when it's marching under the banner of state accommodation through this language of freedom and diversity. And like how people collectively are going to do that. So I guess I'm just like really resisting this kind of move, which I think is about splitting the left along a line that thinks that identity politics is a bad thing, you know? But I know this is like up for debate.
This is a huge question. And like a lot of people are talking about, how are we going to deal with this stuff when it comes to the U.S.? I'm sure you saw it, but there was a piece that was written on North Shore counterinfo. And it was some people that had gone that were from out of town and they went. And one of the things that was written was kind of like, you know, we don't know if like basically confronting these people with like traditional anti-fascist tactics is going to like be a good idea, that might even further entrench them or like blow this thing up. I'm kind of curious your thoughts on that. Like, have things just gotten so bad now that there needs to be a response? Because it definitely seems like it'd be much better, of course, if there was like a popular mobilization.
Yeah, totally. Like, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's what we're going to keep trying to build toward, right? It's precisely those kinds of popular mobilizations where we can experience and exert our own power rather than waiting around for the state, which we just, I mean, it's so clear that we can't expect them to, we can't expect them to keep people safe. Right. And I think that we can draw some lessons from other cities in the Canadian context that have faced copycat versions of this truck convoy. So as you may have seen, as your listeners may have heard, last weekend, various right-wing activists across the Canadian context were drawing inspiration and trying to do these kinds of convoys in other cities. So like in Winnipeg, in Vancouver, and now along the border in various places as well. And one of the most dismal
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we are looking back to an interview we did with Dr. Ishmael Traore on an event called Where Are All the Black People?, which was an event series looking at the lack of diversity in academia. Here is that interview.
So first, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about the series, Where Are All the Black People?
Yeah, so my name is Ishmael Traore. My gender pronouns are he, him, his, and I'm here on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people in South Vancouver, BC. The series Where Are All the Black People stems from two things. One, the underrepresentation of Blackness at UBC and, as the book Equity Myth shows, across the universities in Canada, especially in leadership. And it also is informed in part by the reckoning on racism that was elevated last year following the murder of George Floyd, and also incidents of racism at UBC that has happened 2-3 years now that have caught the public imagination and concerns of a lot of people. And it also stems from